Welcome to Wake Up Podcast with Viv Trader. Viv is a curious person with the desire to embrace different opinions and expertise. Her focus is health, well-being, environmental, and political. She holds a non-judgmental approach and she is objective. Viv's ambition is to raise your awareness and contribute to a better world. She is also the founder of Vivalicious Food, which produces an innovative vegan baby food with added omega-3 from an algae oil. www.vivaliciousfood.com.
All right. So today I have the real honor and pleasure of having you, Dr. Howard Eisenberg, here as my guest. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Viv, so much for the invitation. Thank you.
And you are in Toronto in Canada?
Yes, I'm in that area, but more in the woods.
Yeah. Sounds lovely. Now, Howard, can you please tell me a little bit about yourself? Who are you?
Well, it's hard to tell you a little bit of myself. just as an honest answer, not in a bragging way at all. But let's start with more immediately. I'm a medical doctor. I'm a physician. I've also been a faculty member at several universities, so I'm also very involved in the educational sector. And I've had a long time interest, curiosity, in the nature of reality. Just how do things work? What is the true, version or story of reality? Like growing up, even as a young child, I was aware that there were different people brought up in a different faith. And they were brought up to believe in many of those situations that their faith was the only true faith. Furthermore, that all other professed faiths were almost like demonic, like evil, not like not to be followed, but if anything, suppressed, avoided. So that was as I grew up in childhood, and I came to the realization, just intuitively, no one, encouraged me to think this way. This doesn't make sense. If it is true that there is a God or gods, then why are there so many different religions? Which one's right? And how do you determine that? Or are they all wrong? Which, later on as I became more educated and more aware of the scientific model and progress, that was one of the reasons why science largely discarded the religions, thinking again, well, there's no sort of credibility. They're all over the map in what they're saying and what they're claiming. Nevertheless, I repeat, I still had that curiosity, though. So it was one thing to wonder, like, something's wrong here. They can't all be right if they're all saying the other ones are wrong, just logically. But that doesn't mean you want to throw the baby with the bathwater. So on my own, I pursued through some bookstores, unusual books about people who were exploring other aspects of reality, both from a science fiction point of view, believe it or not, because, that's imaginative, and we'll come back to it later on. It's a large part of my discoveries and my work in my book now, the new one.
Yeah.
But also found out there was some research going on sort of extended capacities of the human mind, which we now sort of call parapsychology. Study of so-called psychic phenomena. And one of the leaders at the time in the West, and particularly in America, was J.B. Rye down in North Carolina. Actually went out at one point and met him. I know you want a more concise answer. So I had this curiosity. I was exploring things. And then also became more involved in my medical practice. But because of what I had already learned about the powers of the mind, my model of my medical practice and psychotherapy practice was quite different from that of my peers at the time. It was more of what we sometimes call mind-body medicine or behavioral medicine or mind over matter. Rarely ever prescribed medications for any patients for all types of conditions, but I would teach them how to use their minds to change how they perceived or how they connected or how they balanced and so on. It wasn't my power. I was just, teaching them these things. I also went into the consulting realm. I realized as a physician, it's sort of a reactive way of being of help to people in the sense that they first have to have a problem, then they come to you as a doctor. And usually as a doctor, I would be seeing individuals, even though it might be more of a family issue or even perhaps a company issue or a departmental issue. So I wanted to do something more holistically, more proactively. I wanted to do something that was more preventative, but also had greater outreach than just the few patients that I could personally see one-on-one, so to speak. So I went into the corporate realm as a consultant, management consultant, and as a trainer. Worked up with a Fortune 100 international clientele, and I was ill on the side. Wow. I started my medical practice. Mm-hmm. But I had abandoned my deep interest earlier in my life, as I mentioned to you, in how things work. I was more just working in these various ways. I didn't want to just, I'm a multi-track thinker. It just was something that just came naturally for me to have that interest and desire to do more than one thing at a time. A few years ago, I was invited because of my past work in parapsychology, and I had written a book on it a half a century ago called Inner Spaces, Parapsychological Explorations of the Mind. Because of that, someone who knew my work way back when invited me just a few years ago to give a keynote presentation to the annual conference of an association of healers, people who use therapeutic touch, like in the Bible, the laying on of hands, so to speak. And to honor the invitation, I did a very deep dive into the parapsychological research literature, which I had not really been very involved in for almost half a century, and also what was happening in the world of modern physics, and what was happening in the studies of comparative religions, and what we're discovering about the indigenous, you know, teachings and their relevance for the crises we're facing now, and the latest research on the brain functioning with psychedelics and neuroplasticity. And this is all scientific. I'm just approaching this for this keynote presentation. But all of a sudden, unexpected to me completely, Viv, and not at first welcome, was a sudden realization, like the dots just connected suddenly. And I had what some people would call a revelation or a realization or insight, if you want to use simpler terms. But it was powerful. And I suddenly understood that our whole belief and the teaching in our Western culture, that there's an external physical world, and we are an accidental product of evolutionary experiments, just randomness, some things taking more than others over the years, and that there is no real meaning to our lives, nor to the universe we live in. And that's the belief most people have, that there's this independent, external, material reality, and we somehow are an accidental product of it. And beyond that, there's no meaning. And the strange thing about that is, says in my first chapter, the chapter title is Things Are Not As They Seem. That belief people have is so contrary to reality. And we don't have to go too deep about that. But for example, what we call solid objects, and you can talk about anything in that regard. So maybe the desk, you know, or the chair that we have right now, or the computer screen people may be using, we call them solid. And if you, let's say, you know, knock it with your, you know, knuckle or something,
yeah,
it feels
yeah.
solid. You hear mm-hmm. the sound of solidity
yes.
too. But in physics, we know, and this is not theory, we know it's more than 99.999999% empty, empty space. And then we say, okay, but there's still some physical particles that fundamentally make it up. This is part of the belief in the external world. Except in modern physics, they're finding out there are no distinct particles that are the building blocks. There's only zones of probability. They don't exist until a human observes them. And this is what the physicists themselves are now saying. So some have called it, like the physicist Wheeler, we live in a participatory universe. It's not that we are simply a product of the universe. We are connected to the universe, and the universe also needs us for its existence. So let me go back to the insight. So this is all in seconds.
Wow, very profound.
But with that also came very heavy emotional sadness and fear. And it was like, oh my gosh, this means I'm all alone. Like all of this is just in one way coming out of my mind, my imagination. There is nothing physically out there. And that includes people too. It's just out of my mind. And that was horrifically, again, sad and scary, which I did not expect. Not the insight, not that feeling emotionally. But then almost immediately, fortunately, it expanded into something totally different. And I realized I'm not alone. I'm part and connected to everyone and everything. And now everything is different. So not only do I have this very different understanding of how reality works, it also helps me understand profoundly why our world, this we call this the consensual reality, our waking reality, which is to me a level of reality, but a surface. Like if you look at the tip of an iceberg, you see the iceberg, but most of the iceberg, 2/3 at least, is below the water level. You don't see it. So this is what we're sort of more aware of in this level of awareness. And in this world, we are facing multiple existential threats. I don't want to go too dark here, but global climate change is a very frightening reality, even though some people are still deniers of it and think it's some conspiracy. It's all too real. Here in my area, Toronto, Canada, this last summer, we had some days when Toronto had the worst air quality index in the entire world from the fires of the Northern Canadian forests. I used to think of the forest as, you know, the lungs of the planet and as a wonderful resource. And I actually chose to live in the trees as I do right now outside Toronto. I never thought of them, so to speak, as a threat or so fragile. And yet I know still a lot of people are not getting it. They're not talking of such things. Some are suffering now from what's called in my professional psychiatry, eco-anxiety. I feel horrible for the young children who've had no say in the choices the adults have made, and not just historically the choices we've made, but the ones we're still making right now. When I hear governments and corporations talking about, you know, major reductions of carbon emissions in 10 to 20 years, I think it's insane. We need it right now. Right now.
And why are we not talking about climate change? Why is that?
So I think there's a number of reasons. I think one is a defense mechanism, we would say in psychiatry, something we do to sort of protect ourselves from being more upset in some way, more stressed. So the expression we use is being in denial. So there are people literally who are in denial of it. I don't mean by that they're actively thinking, you know, that they just won't believe anything, or that they're protecting themselves, but it's like a subconscious defense mechanism. Also, as you know, there's so much information being shouted out at us right now, and I'll say in some ways manipulated because of the algorithms that are learning our, you know, preferences and weak spots, so to speak, to capture us. So there's a great overwhelm of information, but increasing lack of clarity as to which is, first of all, valid, and secondly, what might be, you know, logical and wise. So it's confounding people's thinking. Another reason is that when we are very stressed, and I think most of humankind now is very stressed for various reasons, so global change is only one of them, but as we know in part, you know, that has immediate or pretty immediate ramifications. So there are a lot of what are sometimes now called climate refugees from countries that have been devastated more so far by climate change. And sadly, it's largely third world countries that had no part in creating this mess so unfairly. And that's causing, you know, mass waves of immigration, as you may know, and unstabilization of political governments in a number of countries right now, reevaluating, you know, their previous more open humanitarian policies, as you know, in the European Union, for example. There are so many things that are off the rails right now. The breakdown of democracy. Until a few years ago, I'm in Canada, but I think the U.S., my neighbor to the south, was regarded as a pillar of democracy in the world, an inspiration for many people that no matter what your background is, if you work hard enough, you know, you can make it, have the American dream, so to speak. And now it's on the verge of being, if not already, a failing democracy. And it may go to the other extreme. As some know, but it's not just here. Back to the European Union, the UK pulled out of the European Union, as you know. There's wars going on right now in Europe, in the Middle East. I could talk about the crisis and the epidemic of loneliness. Many surveys are showing in the general population more and more people are complaining of loneliness. In the UK and Japan, they've actually appointed federal ministers with portfolios for loneliness. They take it so seriously. The Surgeon General of the United States has come out and authored a book of his own on the epidemic of loneliness. And largely, it's been caused by our dependency on smartphones. The smarter the phones become, the dumber we become. And now we're introducing AI and artificial intelligence without any regulation. So I'm seeing increasing, almost, I would say, from a psychiatric lens, insanity in the mess humans are making of what they had achieved, of their environment, and the destructiveness to so many other species going extinct. On one level, you know, metaphorically, you could say we've just, for the second time, been expelled from the Garden of Eden because we can't go back to what we enjoy. There's no water anywhere on the planet that's in the outer environment, anywhere, that's free of microplastics. And who knows what else? I mean, we've really messed it all up. But let me go back on a more positive note. I think we've messed it up because we have believed and almost worshipped material reality. And I don't understand the systemic relationship with ourselves. So everything is interrelated. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, referred to us as living with interbeing. We're all interconnected. The indigenous teaching is very much that way too. For them, they're connected to nature. And I don't mean just because they maybe eat some food from nature. An intimate connection. It's alive to them broadly. Even the rocks, even the soil and the clouds. And as I'm coming to this understanding that we are being deceived by the wrong moral reality to our peril, because I think of this now as an existential risk to humankind, as we know humankind, I felt then compelled, called, that I had to speak out and share what I've learned. And I wrote my book as what I called and meant as a global wake-up call. And I really appreciate, you know, the extent with, in part through the internet, that I can speak and reach, you know, to people in other areas of the world that previously would not have been able to reach, because it's a global message. We're all part of the same family. We all come from the same underlying source. And my book is not about speculation. It's all hard science, impeccable logic. And I actually give people exercises to experience some of these things, the reality bit, within minutes, with no special training. Amazing. So I'm hoping other people will learn from it, and I hope other people will teach from it, and perhaps even preach from it and lead from it. You know, a candle can light the darkness, and I'm trying as best I can. And I also feel, though, I have no choice. But when you know what I now know, it's not a choice.
How serious is climate change? I mean, how much time have we got?
You know, when I wrote my book, which was almost 2 years ago, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists puts out something called the Doomsday Clock, where they track what they consider various potential world threats to our existence. And they've been doing this for a few decades. International scientists and impeccable credentials. And when I wrote my book, I had noted just recently that they had released a press release that they had moved the position of the clock to the closest it had ever been to annihilation, 100 seconds before midnight, which was frightening. Now, currently, if I understand correctly, it's 90 seconds before midnight. And that last move to 90 seconds, I believe, was before, if I remember correctly, the European war, before runaway inflation. I could go on. So to go back to your question, I can't put it in terms of time. I just know it's urgent. It's a very slight window of opportunity. I mean, even what I'm doing myself on one level, we could say is, admit, you know, illogical, crazy, wasteful. To spend so much of my own, you know, unlimited financial resources and time doing this, when there's so much, as I said before, people tuned out or distracted or don't even know how to think anymore. And I'm trying to wake up the whole world. It's easy to say, well, it's just crazy. It's silly. But I also know it's not impossible. No one can tell me it's impossible. And I have to try.
And what do we need to do to tackle this urgency? What can every single human being do to take responsibility right now?
We need to demand, not ask, for way more accountability from our various leaders, be they government leaders, be they corporate leaders, be they religious leaders, way more accountability. But we also need facilitation to learn how to listen to each other. We have to learn how to build on the ideas of each other instead of suppress or compete. So it requires also some skill in emotional regulation and communication. These can be taught. It is not difficult, but it's a real need out there right now. If I put it in psychiatric or even neurological brain terms, there's a primitive part of our brain that we have as humans that all the major animals have as well below us, called the amygdala. And it is basically the stress center of the brain, the fight or flight center.
Mode, yeah.
It's instinctive and it's very, very powerful. When it is activated because of something we fear or that's angering us, it causes the blood from the top part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, which is our thinking part of our brain, to drain away and more towards this amygdala. It's like pouring oil on a fire. That means then that our fear or anger gets more intense, but our ability to think is also reduced. It's like the computer goes offline. Now we can teach people that just because fear comes up or anger comes up, as I put it to my patients, you can learn to think through it. You can learn to modulate, to balance it, not be controlled or restricted by it. But this is a skill much of humanity does not have right now. Easy to teach.
But can you tell me how to do it? Can you tell me some strategies how to do it?
Well, for example, in communication, and it's harder right now that we're, working with screens, but there is a real benefit, powerful benefit, when you're able to encounter people in, let's call it the everyday world, not just through a screen, and make direct eye contact. It's so important. When people fall in love in various, parts of the world, different cultures, they spend more time intentionally on purpose, just looking at each other. It just feels so good just to look at each other.
Yeah, it does.
And
yeah.
After a while, when you're, used to being with your partner, our mind gets distracted and we're now looking at other people or other things, or we're talking to our partner maybe, but while we're reading a book or looking at something on the screen. Like multitasking, it's not the same connection. So one immediate thing, coming back to your question, is to become more aware and intentional for eye contact with people. Don't be so afraid. It's a good thing. It helps connect us. Another one, back to your question, in terms of like our own emotional regulation. So that's where connection, a very quick thing to know. But for our own, again, emotional regulation, when we're upset or concerned by something, one of the fastest ways to calm down the nervous system, in technical terms, we call it downregulation of the nervous system of the brain, is a form of breathing, which is, again, very simple, and I can explain it right now. Broadly, I call this deep or abdominal or diaphragmatic breathing, different words. Nothing esoteric, but the roots of it are in many of the indigenous practices as well, many of the meditation practices. And again, quite validated by our understanding now also in Western medical science. Simply, it's this. You become more aware of your breathing in and out. And then, I'll explain this to you first. And then you switch to a different pattern, which I'm going to explain now. You want your inhalation phase, your in-breath, you're taking air in, to be approximately twice as long in duration as the out breath, as when you breathe out the exhalation. And we also want a pause between you have taken an in breath before you start breathing out. And then after you have, again, breathed out, exhaled, we want another pause, a little longer, and then go back to the inhalation. One way to make it a little easier for people, so you're not using a clock and there's some accuracy of it, is to count in your mind as you're doing it. So for example, let's say with the in-breath, let's say we start with four. One, two, three, four. And then one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, and so on. Now, I'll explain what that's doing to your body internally. And I repeat, this is not speculation. We know this. The largest nerve in the human body is the vagus nerve. Most nerves only go one way. It's like a one-way street. So you have a sensory nerve, which brings information from some part of your body to the brain. And we have nerves that go from the brain to the muscles, for example, to allow us to move. But the vagus nerve is a two-lane superhighway. It goes in both directions, up and down. When you change your breathing the way I just explained, you're stimulating the vagus nerve. And the vagus nerve is like, if you like, the braking pedal in a car. It slows down the activity, the excitement in the brain. It doesn't knock you out. You have still alertness, coordination, but the overwhelm. It's like, you know, volume control. It's too loud, lower it. And it does it within a minute or two. It's fast. Okay, so that's a quick emotional self-regulation skill. I could go on, but those are two, you know, immediate.
Wow, that's great to know. I think in the vagus nerve is so crucial as well for our thinking, right?
That's right. And while we're on that too, another part I'll bring into it, relating part of your question and also what I've discovered in my book, is about the role of the heart. So as I said, we have been taught the wrong model of reality of believing that there's an external, independent physical world. We've also been taught the wrong model of scientific understanding that our mind, our consciousness, comes out of the head brain. There is no evidence at all that the head brain produces consciousness. That's a pretty dramatic statement, but I mean that. There's none. There's no evidence. All we have is what we call correlational evidence, meaning that if you stimulate a certain part of the brain with an electrode, for example, something maybe will change in what the person reports they experience or some movement the body may make. That's what we call correlational evidence. Or a drug, again, you know, may alter again someone's sense of consciousness or how they can work with their body. But that does not mean that the head brain is the source of our consciousness. If you accidentally spill something on your computer, it may not work. But it doesn't mean that no one else can not access, you know, the internet or the other person, you know, you were maybe in a meeting with through a Zoom call or something like that. Because the signal is not coming from your computer. Your computer is just picking it up, just interpreting it to you. And there's great evidence to show, again, RP, that the brain is not the source of consciousness. It's more like a filter. Somewhat like a radio, actually. It receives and filters. By say filter, meaning it restricts.
Mm-hmm.
And things like meditation and psychedelic drugs, when used properly, expand or loosen those filters. So there's a different awareness, different level of consciousness, you know, that people are able to experience. We're still staying with more conventional understanding in science. So as I said, the notion that the head brain is wrong, but even more fundamentally, the notion that the brain in our head is the brain of our body is wrong. Just speaking in simple physical terms right now and basic science, this is not anything speculative, but it's the type of things I went into and, you know, sharing in my book. So in reality, all humans have at least three physical brains. We have a head brain. We also have a heart brain, and we also have a gut brain, sometimes called the microbiome. The microbiome is composed of trillions of bacteria. Collectively, they have more DNA, more genetic material than we do in our so-called own human body. The microbiota can also secrete the so-called, you know, neurotransmitters that we think of in the brain. For example, the most popular types of antidepressants in psychiatry are ones that work on modifying serotonin function in the head brain. However, 90% of serotonin is actually manufactured and secreted by the bacteria in our guts in a large colon, not in the head brain.
Wow.
So the heart, we now know, has its own nervous system. It has actual neurons. It has its own memory system. The heart has more nerves that go up to the brain that can modify the head-brain function, and the head-brain can modify the heart function. The heart can also secrete the powerful love hormone, oxytocin. And there's some evidence the heart might be like a portal to an intuitive awareness, to our deeper level of connection with everything. So to also become more guided by the heart. And there's expressions like, you know, warm-hearted people and path of the heart. Maybe there's deep truth and wisdom in that. I think there is. So if we also guided ourselves more by path of the heart, and what does that mean? Well, come back to conventional science too. I try to integrate it all as you're hopefully,
it's brilliant.
You know, capturing.
Love it.
And I'm hoping not overwhelming you.
No, I love it. It's very enjoyable.
The noted physician and researcher, Dr. Hans Selye, is the one who is the person who brought the concept of stress onto the scientific map and public consciousness from his research initially with laboratory animals under various conditions of stress. And then he extended his work to how stress affects us as humans. In his later years, he was focusing more not just on proving the stress concept that when there's stress, you have all these, you know, insults and deterioration of various body organs, and explaining the role of things like cortisol, the stress hormone, and so on. But in his later years, he became more and more interested also in the preventative aspect. Okay, so now we've documented it is a real thing. It's across species as well. So now how do we reduce it, especially coming back to humans and being a physician? And he discovered in the later years that one of the best things we could do for our personal sense of being overwhelmed by stress, and we're all pretty well overwhelmed right now with what's going on, as we know, is to be more aware and concerned about the needs of others, which he called altruism, the altruistic ego. Now, at first seems counterintuitive. If you're overly stressed, it doesn't seem to make sense. You can reduce your stress by taking better care of someone else's needs. But it does. One, you're switching from the amygdala, I explained before, to your prefrontal cortex. You're now thinking more resourcefully, more creatively, more adaptively. So you are. Plus, we can't see ourselves as others do, but you can see someone more objectively and maybe see how to help them in a way that they cannot. So you're both helping yourself, because when you do this from your heart for someone else, it reduces the cortisol level, which is the inflammatory hormone, and other, you know, things that are just lowering your own stress level. You're also probably helping someone to some degree. And sometimes some of those people have appreciation and they will reciprocate. You never know when, you know, and they'll be there for you someday. So that's sometimes what I'll call, you know, working more path of the heart. And with modern science, you know, medically explaining it too.
And helping someone can be small gestures, doesn't have to be very large.
Exactly.
Action can be a small one, like saying hello and smiling to someone in checkup queue.
Right. Just good intention, just good vibes. Yes. Mm. We so need that. People are afraid of just smiling strangers these days. And people often don't smile anymore. They're so, you know, down and worn out. Smiling is good.
Mm. And when you smile at someone, they always smile back at you as well. And you feel so much better.
Often. And, you know, and I remember, you know, times before the pandemic restrictions and so on, when people were out and about more, walking by sometimes a mother with a baby in a carriage or stroller, and babies often are curious and they're looking, you know, at people. So often they don't care if they know you or not when they're out and about. And I remember a number of times locking eyes with a baby or an infant, and we both smiled. I didn't know the mother. I didn't know the child. Just, you know, really nice feeling. And so many people have lost that. They're busy looking at their screens if they're out and about these days, or they're afraid to look at people.
Yeah. Now, talking about screens, what do we need to do there with our children and our younger generation to so they don't end up in this loneliness epidemic?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think there's a real value benefit in our technology if we use it mindfully. So when we use it this way, when we intentionally are choosing to listen to a program or be involved in a meeting for good purpose, that's an intelligent and good way to use this. If we had the easy alternative of meeting in person, I think that is better, but many of us don't. and it still enables so much that we could never have done before, most of us, on the positive side. But I do think we have to be more mindful of what we are allowing and reinforcing directly or indirectly in our children. And I think it's good for them too to have the ability to, you know, have a wider field potentially of communication in the small family or world or town they may be born into, but they don't have the wisdom yet to know how to properly work with that type of technology. And the technology has been weaponized intentionally. It's not an accident. Those algorithms do track and modify the things that we are exposed to, whether we realize it or not, when we turn on our devices. It's intentional. There's even psychologists have been hired by some of these companies to help make it addictive, and it is. So the kids don't know this, of course, and many adults are caught by it as well. So I think, back to your question, I think parents should, without guilt, limit screen time, even if the kids complain, but everybody else, you know, doesn't have that regulation. And I think they should not only restrict the screen time for young children, but also supervise what they're connecting to. What are they watching? What games are they playing? There's so much toxic stuff out there.
How about social media? Is that addictive as well?
Very much.
From a psychological viewpoint, what kind of an impact does social media have in your well-being?
I would say it's the prime reason for this epidemic of loneliness in the world right now. It's seductive. It's just so easy. Like, you know, before, if you wanted to talk to someone, a few decades ago, you had to be where there was a phone connected, landline. But now it's 24/7, as we all know. People will contact other people all over, you know, the clock, and not just because they're in different time zones. It's the type of thing, even when people go on vacation. Usually, you know, they still say, you know, connected. But here's the weird part about it. So in one way, these things, and even as we're working now with video connection, connect us. But it's not as a full spectrum, full fidelity connection, heartfelt connection, as if we have the alternative to be in person. And many people, because it's so easy to rely on, you know, the phone as a way of texting for communication, they're losing the appreciation, especially younger people who didn't grow up with what some of us, you know, previously experienced, the more informal socialization. So they don't know quite what they're missing. But for example, I find it amusing, but it to me also demonstrates how addictive this is. When people are in an active text communication with someone else, so in other words, you send a text, you get a reply right away, you reply to that one. So it's not just like, you know, it's asynchronous, you've sent it and you'll wait till the next day or whatever, they may reply. But when that's going on, you're doing with your phones and you're not using your phone as a phone. And to me, that again is crazy, but it's just how addictive it is. And let me explain a little more of the science behind that, why I say this mm-hmm. to you. When we are in face-to-face communication without screens in the everyday world, approximately 92% of our communication, both ways, is what we call body language. Only approximately 8% is verbal, is the words. Even the modulation of our voice, which is part of body language, counts for about 30% of the impact of how we're communicating. So in other words, not just the words, but the way we speak, the way we modulate the words, has more than three times impact on people than the words themselves. But when you're texting, you lose all that modulation, all that, you know, finesse, subtlety, and it's not unimportant. It doesn't feed the heart. It's just feeding like more of a computer way of thinking. And as we're moving more and more into an AI world, and very rapidly, as you know, like almost at light speed, it's being more and more addictive. Because if it can give you an answer right away, if it can save you employees, like, you know, why not? And also everybody else is doing it, you have to do it too. And ultimately, what's going to control us? Mm-hmm. I mean, too heartless.
And the thing about the texting is so easy to get a misunderstanding and end up in a conflict, right? because you don't have the emotional, you know, so it's just words, and depending on your own state of mind, so it will create more conflict than.
Yeah.
Scary.
So I think, you know, when it is safe in terms of infectious diseases or whatever, or political things that are going on in the world, if we can, we need to have more in-person connection with people. So even back to the phone, being realistic about modern life right now, if you're using your phone and you're in an active text going back and forth, use it to speak. It's much richer. It's much more meaningful, much more nurturing. Mm. So some of these simple things like eye contact, you know, an example I just met the phone, doesn't have to all be so profound.
It's almost like the younger generation is scared to talk on the phone as well. It's too close. They almost have like that fear of speaking.
And they're going to be so vulnerable to AI.
And how will that show up?
More psychopathic behavior. People just not caring at all about the consequences on others. What's happening even to their own quality of life. Becoming actually machine-like. And in a way you could say that, you know, it's happening weird enough to humanity. We're becoming less human, more machine-like.
Is that due to greed from the larger corporations in the world?
I think there's two great emotions that drive most of us right now. Fear, and the other one is greed. Yeah. The indigenous teaching here in America, known as the Law of Seven Generations, is something that I think, again, it's, I have it in my book, we need to go back to the wisdom. And what it meant was, if a person, a family, a tribe was to make some major decision, they would try to think out in advance the implications, the consequences, seven generations into the future. Whereas we, by contrast, are almost totally captivated by short-term greed. Just because we can do something, just we can get something, you know, we go for it. Can I really afford it? Is it really healthy for me? Is it really fair to others that I've taken it from maybe someone else could have had it? Or the workers were exploited to produce it? Is it fair for me to use it when they've been so exploited? You know, and so on. We just don't have those considerations enough.
So we need to rebuild the world. Everything is sort of falling down right now, and we need to rebuild it. So we as men can thrive and be more in love and enjoy our lives and have less stress. Yes.
And I think it's possible, as I said. You know, I don't know what the odds are of my succeeding. I also don't care. I know it's possible. And that maybe brings us into the realm of imagination now, coming back to this. As people are also spending more and more time, either on smartphones or just on the internet with their screens, they're more and more, again, focused on the outside. And I've already explained the belief that the reality is in the outside is wrong, let alone, you know, if it's coming through electronic media or something more tangible. But many people think that there's so much out there right now that's free. Why not, you know, take advantage of it on the internet in various ways and various apps? And many of them are free, but there's still a cost to us, which most of us don't appreciate. And the cost is to our attention. They're attention grabbing. We're losing control of our own attention, which is fundamental. Now let me go deeper and to explain what I'm getting at. Contrary to what we've been, again, taught, progress in Western science has not been through laboratory methodical experimentation. It's been through more things like dreaming. In fact, everything ever, ever invented in terms of scientific discovery or mechanical inventions, everything has come out of imagination. Everything. And in my book, I give a number of prominent examples of very famous scientists, inventors, who openly, you know, have shared that that's how they discovered what they discovered. Even people like Einstein, who many would consider, you know, mathematical genius for his discoveries in physics. But his understanding, his research in a sense in cosmology and physics began when he was young at his age 16. And it began by imagining riding on a beam of light through the universe. That's how he started. And in my book, I, you know, expand on many other examples, which we are so contrary to what we've been taught, what we've assumed about how things are discovered. So this comes back to the neglected power of the imagination and why, you know, I've titled my book, Dream It to Do It.
Mm-hmm.
Envisioning things, bringing forth things can be a form of manifestation if you know how to work with it, which again, I tried to explain. So I'm not just trying to wake up people in the world with my wake-up call, as I put it, to all go like scream, oh my gosh, you know, it's horrible. No, the opposite. Like, wake up out of the nightmare and let's now, again, make it a better world. And we could. We could follow more of the old wisdom of the golden rule. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. It's simple, isn't it?
Treat others as you want them to treat you. Why do we complicate things so much?
Another problem we have, going back to part of your earlier question too, is our egos. Ego separates us, both protectively. You know, we don't want to be embarrassed. We don't want to be neglected or outshone by somebody else. But it's also not enough for most of us in terms of ego to just kind of, you know, make it or keep up with things. Many of us also want to have a little more than others. And that may mean not playing by the rules, to have more. And it may mean, in some cases, in criminal cases, intentionally stealing, taking, or preventing someone else having something. It makes us overly concerned about how other people see us, not how we really are inside, but how they see us. So like the image becomes more important than, you know, the internal reality. And that again is ego. And so we need to learn that our fundamental problem right now, aside from believing in the wrong moral reality, but all being outside material, our fundamental problem is the divisiveness we have. We need to come back to the realization humankind is one, and more profoundly, we're one with the whole universe. And there's a way to work with that, to transform some of this very toxic reality we have right now into something much more beautiful and sustainable.
How can people, if they have feel like they're driven very much by the ego, how can they reduce their ego, become more aware? And how do you connect more to your heart if you are, you know, in your head and in your thoughts? And have you got some ideas for people to...
I mentioned before the expression, at least here, of somebody being warm-hearted. People being a warm-hearted person, a warm-hearted embrace, you know, warm-hearted sentiment. If we learned to tune in and feel people more from that level. So, for example, if I asked you right now, while we're just talking, you know, to think of someone or some people you have loving feelings for, you can almost feel a difference in that area. And if I asked you the opposite, think of some people, as you know right now, either in your personal life or on the world stage, who you might feel almost hateful towards, different feeling. Soft, hard. It's subtle, but we can learn, you know, to be guided by it. Again, path of the heart.
No one wants to feel fear. Don't you agree with that? Do you think we enjoy feeling fear?
No, I don't. But I think there are certain, unfortunately, fairly powerful political leaders who purposely know how to stoke fear and control people by doing that. As I explained, when the amygdala is activated from fear, it deactivates the prefrontal cortex, the thinking part of the brain. It goes offline. And I think it's totally intentional. And then what they do is they flip the people from being in a fearful state to get their ear and to then marshaling their anger. When we feel fear, we feel weak, all of us. When you feel anger, strange enough, you feel strength. I mean, it doesn't mean you're going to solve, you know, whatever problems you might be confronting, but it's a stronger feeling. So when he converts people, first he stores people's, you know, stir up the again fear, and then when you convert that to anger, and you direct it, you can then use that as a very unfortunately powerful force to disrupt, you know, the rightful leaders or institutions of democracy and so on. And that's what we're seeing in the world right now. So no, we don't want it, but there are certain, again, malicious people who do want us to feel it, and they're purposely stoking it very intentionally. And it works.
Mm. And what big role has media to do with the fear?
Media makes it much worse, because media mainly focuses on the negative things, the problems in the world. Not with solutions. I mean, one thing, you know, there's a problem and here's some potential solution, or good people are working on it. It's more like, you know, when people sometimes are on the highway and they pass a bad road accident, some people will slow down just to look, just to gawk, not to help, just to look. Or if they're in an area where there's maybe a burning home, sometimes, again, they just stop to look. Not, is there anything we can possibly do? Do the people need shelter? Do they need some clothes? You know, they had to run out of their house and so on.
Why is that? Is that because they have the fear, or is it? Why wouldn't you help if you see someone
because it can have this divisiveness, because we don't feel the connection. And we don't, you know, think of back to the wisdom of the golden rule. Like, if that happened to me, what would I want my neighbors or you know, passerbys to do? Mm. Similarly, as you may know, there's been a lot of assaults in public. Some of them are you know, videotaped and put on the internet. So instead of helping, they're filming it and sharing it for publicity. It's so distorted.
Mm. What have been your biggest fear in your life so far?
Well, we're at it right now, first of all. So, it, you know, we all have challenges you go through life. But I don't remember ever having, you know, the level of that concern that I have right now. I mean, I lived through things like the Cuban Missile Crisis, which for a while we were maybe on the verge of a nuclear war, you know, and some other things that were very destabilizing. But no, I mean, I'm at the red level of alert right now. You asked me earlier, how much time do we have? I said, I don't know that we can talk in terms of time. I'll just say right now, there's a window of possibility. I don't know if it's months. If it's years, it's not many years. So again, when I hear these government corporate leaders talking about their 10 and 20 year plans, or repeat, to reduce carbon reductions, it's insane. That is so, so off the reality of what we need.
We need more people like you talking about this, so people can understand how urgent this is, that we are actually in a very serious crisis.
And that's why I do this. And
yeah,
and that's why I said when we started, you could ask anything, whatever I can share, it's helpful. I'm doing whatever I
yes.
can.
And let's talk about just the stress, for instance, the implications stress has on the human being. Can you tell mm-hmm. me a little bit about that?
Well, one of the things that stress can cause too, and is a very high level globally right now, and again, with things that keep happening, it's going up and up, unfortunately. So there's an expression, which is not a scientific expression, but it's a common complaint of the people. They call it brain fog, where they really feel that they can't think as clearly. They make more errors. They need to take more time to rest. There's no particular, so far at least, you know, medical cure for it or total explanation. But they have noticed, particularly during the pandemic and some of the population surveys, there's a higher and higher level of complaint in the general population of brain fog. And I'm not talking about what sometimes happens to a long COVID, where you can get a form of brain fog too. And I'm just talking in general, not because of the infection. Because again, people are just so, so badly overwhelmed.
Mm.
Everywhere.
Does it lead to depression as well? Do you get depressed? If you have brain fog, do you end up having depression as well?
Not necessarily.
Any correlation?
Well, first of all, in depression, It does affect cognition. So it's not just like an emotional thing where people feel sad. It does affect their thinking ability as well. But it doesn't mean the opposite is true too. It doesn't mean that brain fog has to be associated with depression. No, it's more cognitive function, not emotional. Their ability literally to think is impaired. So when you put all this together, you know, ego, impaired thinking, so much false information and manipulation out there, it's quite a mess to navigate through. But it's possible.
Very toxic cocktail, right?
Yeah. But on the positive side too, just as, you know, I've come onto your radar screen and you've invited me, I'm finding people all over the world who I call it are aware and care. Because I think with the awareness comes caring, because you realize the connection and the importance. And so I'm hopeful that way too, that some of the people like yourself I would have never perhaps met before. And there are some groups forming, even as you may know, in your country in Sweden, Inner Development Goals, for example, which is international now. So I'm encouraged. These are not political players and they're not people with deep financial resources. But I think, you know, that's on the material realm. But if the spirit is strong and if, you know, we really connect in a heartfelt way with each other, then maybe we can change our reality.
And you were saying as well, you've been out talking as a consultant to corporations. In terms of the future, do you think corporations need to change their values? So rather than having profit as a number one driver forward, there has to be different values that are more
absolutely
fundamental.
Absolutely. You know, I've been brought up in a capitalist economy all my life, and assumed as maybe to do when, you know, we hear something you're familiar with, that it's, you know, it's the right or it's the best way. But now when I see the extreme inequities of the distribution of wealth, and when I realize too that those who are the wealthiest are often the least charitable, and I don't mean about donations they give for publicity and tax write-offs, but that amongst the least, you know, charitable and caring. And I'm seeing this increasing, this, you know, increasing concentration of wealth at the very, very top. And again, with people who head those institutions and corporations who just really don't care about other people. I don't mean humanity itself. I mean, even just people in the street they pass, they just don't. We're just, to them, assets. We're not people. So I think corporations absolutely have to change their value system. Many years ago, I was involved as a consultant for a while with an association in the U.S. called the Business for Social Responsibility. And they had, I believe, a dual bottom line. This is many years ago. So one was return, you know, to stakeholders, so the investors of the company, profitably. But the other one was also returned to their communities. And that was part of their mission statement. That was part of their obligation. And I think they even put it partly in financial terms too. I don't remember the exact figures. It's years ago again, as I said, but I think they were giving an actual percentage of their net profits every year for various community initiatives. It was not for advertising. It was not for marketing. It was genuine in efforts to give back. So I think we need more of that. It probably has to be somewhat regulated to start, because I don't think these self-interested people and corporations are only going to do this. I also think there has to be a much fairer distribution of the wealth. It's just not fair to allow the way it is right now. But I don't mean in a revolutionary way. Just we need to all put our heads together, our hearts together, because even for the top 1% or 0.1%, if the world goes up in flames, so to speak, they may still exist, you know, in their encampments on the moon or whatever it might be, but it's not nearly going to be as enjoyable a life as we can all have here. Not nearly. Not for themselves and not for the children if they have children. And hopefully enough of them will start realizing that.
What's your viewpoint on small businesses? Do we need more entrepreneurs in the future?
Yes, I'd like to see a world, as I understand it now, where we have more small business owners and have more personal crafts workers. and live in smaller communities where it's easier to know the people broadly around you, and they do complementary things to help each other out, and then have maybe, you know, larger structures that connect some of these other communities. But I think we have to really enrich it, the community level.
And it's nicer too, because, you know, production in smaller scale is much nicer. You know, let's talk about food, for instance. If you have a local bakery that makes bread with a heart, I mean, it tastes...
That's right, exactly. And that's one of the things I enjoy being out here in farm country. You know, I can go to some of the farmers and so on, you know, and get some things that they've really, you know, in a very carefully way, you know, brought forth.
You can see the passion and the love and, you know, the dedication. Yeah. And they saw, and you can feel that when you eat it too. It goes into you, the energy. You can sort of
the
feel their love. Yeah.
There's even been some experiments on that, by the way. Yes, oh, there's something to that. There is, yes.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There were some experiments done at IONS, Institute of Noetic Sciences, California, where they had someone who reputedly had some powers bless some chocolate. And then they had a batch of chocolate, which was not blessed, the control batch. And they gave it to some people to see if there was a difference in the benefits. And there was. I don't remember all the details of it. But the research was done by somebody who I think is one of the most brilliant scientists in this area right now, Dean Radin. At Institute of Noetic Sciences, so very, very credible research.
Yeah, and I think like happy music in factories, you know, staff feel really happy, and you know, rather just dead quiet, it makes because everything is energy, right?
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Our hour is up. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Dr. Howard? It's been so wonderful to have you here. Very profound facts and insights.
Well, I thank you again for the opportunity, and I've also really enjoyed our dialogue. And for your listeners, my message is one of actually hopefulness, but you have to go for it. Don't just leave it to others and hope that way, passively, actively. Dream it to do it.
I hope you got some valuable information today. Wake up, wake up. And thanks for checking in and waking up. See you next time.